Chapter 7. God will speak to you directly. I squeezed in a trip to the Bahamas during Easter just 2 months before our wedding day. It would be good to see those turquoise-striped waters again after 7 years, but my purpose was to scout out possible locations for a large mission outreach. For the first time since our mixed results experiment of taking teenagers to Hawaii 3 years ago, I wanted to take out another group, 100 or more, to put into practice what I'd seen in the waves vision. By now, we had recruited 20 vocational volunteers, but I longed for something more dynamic, something closer to what I'd seen in the vision God had given me. The flower-lined streets of Nassau hadn't changed, nor had the policemen in their white uniforms and pith helmets. As we drove by a beautiful beach, I recalled seeing the continents, the powerful surf, covering them, the kids preaching, helping people. Wouldn't it be just like the Lord to let us have our first big wave right here, where He gave me the vision, I thought. I'd long ago noticed that God often gives advance hints of His plans. If we had 100 kids, I thought, we could possibly reach every home on every one of the 30 out islands of the Bahamas. The next morning, I visited with local leaders from several churches, including my host church, Evangelistic Temple, a low concrete block building in Nassau. And I explained my dream of having 100 young people come to the Bahamas the following summer for a large outreach. I told them the kids would pay their own way. They'd be here to work, not play. They'd give their entire summer to evangelistic projects. The name would say it all, Summer of Service. We'd give ourselves in service to Jesus. The immediate response was exactly what I'd hoped for, a hearty invitation. I was excited as I left the church that morning. When I got back home in a few days, I'd be able to tell Dar that we had already our first major YWAM project. I hurried back to California to my fiancée. We had a classic June wedding in Dar's folks church. Dar came down the aisle to me wearing a white silk gown, her blue eyes sparkling under the veil. My dad and Dar's father shared the ceremony, leading us in our wedding vows. My sister Phyllis sang a solo, and her husband Lynn was one of my groomsmen. Jenny lit the candles while Mom beamed from her front row seat. Two very special guests were there, Aunt Arnette and Aunt Sandra. They sat on opposite ends of the serving table at the wedding reception, pouring tea and coffee from silver pitchers. I had a feeling of completion. A broken circle was mended. "Here, Lauren, darling," Aunt Sandra said, putting down her coffee pitcher and ladling me some fruit punch. "You have a lovely bride, dear, and I know she'll help you with your work." Aunt Sandra returned to pouring coffee, but I knew that it was all right now. Aunt Sandra was rooting for me and my calling, no longer trying to pull me away from it. In front of the Taj Mahal, I had asked God for a partner. I saw it now as a prayer, though at the time it had been only an unspoken yearning. I was looking for a woman who herself had a call to missions, who could mesh with my crazy lifestyle and with my family. Dar fit the bill in every way. There was one more thing I was eager to discover, how she could find her own role in that calling. We decided to take a mission trip through Europe and Asia right after our honeymoon to see if Darlene would hear from God what her role was to be. We spent a honeymoon weekend in Carmel, California, then stored our wedding gifts in the folks' house. Before leaving for overseas, I took Dar by to see our nest egg, a 4-bedroom house in La Puente. I'd been able to buy it with a small down payment, finance the rest with Dad as a cosigner, and rent it out to cover the payments. "It's a little security for the future," I pointed out to my bride. Our upcoming summer of service in the Bahamas was only a year away, but for now our priority was finding out how to work together as a team. After all, I'd been busy doing evangelism for 3 years now, and this trip was to be Dar's introduction to what lay ahead. The last thing I wanted her to feel was like a tag-along. Our trip was half over as we stood before the Taj Mahal. We arrived at full moon. We stood with our arms around each other, gazing at this huge, pearl-like structure gleaming in the blue light. I could really understand as I looked down at Dar. Her hair catching the moonlight, why a man would build such an extravagant monument to his wife. I thought everything was going so well that what happened next took me by surprise. We were in Singapore, living in the small guest room of a mission house built in the days when the British controlled the island. The house had thick walls, high ceilings, creaky fans, bare wooden floors, and a square window with bars. One day I came in to find Dar lying across the bed. I hurried across the dark wooden floor to her side. "Dar, are you sick?" I turned her to me and saw that her eyes were swollen and red from crying. "What's wrong?" Dar did not answer right away. The old ceiling fan futilely pushed around the hot, humid air. "Nothing," she said. "Nothing really, honey." Why do women say that, I wondered. Of course it was something, Dar. Tell me. A fly buzzed in wide circles above the four-postered bed. In the distance, I could hear a Muslim priest calling faithful to prayer. After a while, bit by bit, Dar finally managed to share with me what was bothering her. "Honey," Dar said, they all want me to be somebody I'm not." In country after country, it seemed friends had welcomed my new bride and innocently asked her, "Do you play the piano?" "No," Dar had to say. "Do you sing?" "No." "Which Bible school did you go to?" "St. Francis School of Nursing." "Oh." "Lauren," Dar said, sitting up, dabbing her eyes, "I've been praying that God would do something to my voice. You know how I sound. So that I could sing." I laughed, and I assured her that if I had wanted a girl who could sing and play piano, I would have married one. "Dar," I said, "it sounds as if you want me to tell you what your role is." As I held her hand, I remembered something that kept me from trying to bolster her right now. I recalled myself as a little boy praying desperately behind the couch for my dying daddy, and a man came to the door with a vision about Dad coming home in a coffin, and then Mom's voice saying, with something this important, God would have to tell me. I pulled Dar close and steeled myself. Then I held her at arm's length, looking into her blue eyes with the now red rims. "Honey, this is something you're going to have to get for yourself directly from God. I'm sorry, but I can't help you." It was hard to do, but I walked out of the room and left her alone. Darlene did hear from God for herself. I came back later to find her beaming. "Lauren, God has spoken to me from the story of David and Abigail. Abigail said she would wash the feet of her husband's servants. That's my ministry. I'm to be a servant. A foot washer." It sounded like so little, especially from a strong woman like Dar, but she was happy, and I couldn't help but be happy for her too. I held Dar close, and I thought of what her own word from God really meant. Darlene was the first among many who would be called full-time to YWAM. But each individual would have to find his or her own niche. Ministry didn't have to fit some long-held stereotype. God had a unique work for each one of us, and each person had to hear it from God directly, not just accept my word for what He was saying to them. Dar and I both knew that the basic thing was an attitude of heart. Dar had gotten that right, really right. After Singapore, I watched her carrying out her ministry of foot washing. She would see a harassed missionary's wife. She'd jump in and do the dishes, insisting the woman spend some time with her children. Dar also shined at making whatever room we stayed into our home. She'd picked up some wild flowers and stuck them in a jar, if nothing else. I saw that her serving ministry went into another very important direction. She sensed people's needs and answered their questions, spending time with them one-on-one, hearing them out, planting ideas, giving mature counsel. I was so glad that God had given me Darlene before this big project of the Bahamas. The summer of service was going to be quite an undertaking. The first big wave of young people would soon be going out, and excitement began to churn in me, and I could hardly wait to get to the Bahamas. It was a damp, chilly February evening in 1964, several months later, and Dad had a stack of logs crackling in their flagstone fireplace by the big windows looking out to the San Gabriel Valley. Except for Jenny, who was away at college in Springfield, Missouri, the whole family was there, including Phyllis and Lynn's two children, who were busy playing with blocks in the kitchen. Dar and I were talking excitedly. Even dear Mom didn't have a chance to get a word in edgewise. "We'll have 30 islands as our target," I said, spreading out a map of the Caribbean on the living room floor in front of the fireplace, pointing to a string of dots arcing from Florida toward Dominican Republic. "We'll try to get to all the out islands with our English-speaking kids and to the Dominican Republic with Spanish-speaking kids. We'll be there 3 months." I was glad we'd worked out our dates so that we'd be leaving before the heavy hurricane season. We would fly from Miami to Nassau on the 1st of July, just 5 months from now. From there, the teams would take mailboats to the out islands. The summer of service would cost each participant $160 for those 3 months, including airfare from Miami to Nassau and back. "That's $20 a week, son," Mother said. "Either this is the Lord or you're crazy." She tapped her head. We all laughed, but knowing Mom, she wasn't joking. Dar and I kept the road hot, recruiting more workers for the summer outreach. We went to speak whenever and wherever we were invited. "This summer of service will be a rugged boot camp of faith," we told the young people. "There will be health risks so that you will have to get approval from your parents and your doctor. You'll also need a recommendation from your pastor, but you'll have a chance to make a big difference in people's lives." We told them they would have to raise the $160 themselves, just as Dar and I were doing, and that it would be all work with no time off for sightseeing, no spending money that would make us richer than the islanders. "There won't even be dating while we are on the mission," I said. The tougher we made the conditions, the more kids volunteered. As July 1st drew near, we prayed even harder to be led to the right people. Sometimes our prayers were answered in an unmistakable way. We were in Colorado, and I was speaking to several hundred young people about our trip when I noticed one boy in particular. He was almost 18. He had stick straight hair that was brown and was watching me intently. I heard later that Dar, who was sitting in the crowd, had heard God tell her to speak to a boy in a green sweater about the coming of the summer of service. As soon as the meeting was over, she made a beeline for the same boy. He was wearing a green sweater. She related to him what God had told her a few minutes before. The youth was dumbfounded. He kept hitting his chest with his open palm. I just asked God to have one of you speak to me personally if he wanted me to go." He fixed a straight gaze at Dar and then grinned. Dar grabbed his hand, pumping it up and down. "What's your name?" she asked the boy. "Don. Don Stevens," he said. I had to wonder what special role this Don Stevens might have with YWAM, given this most unusual way we were introduced to him. On one of our recruiting trips, Dar and I had visited my sister Jenny at Evangel College. Jenny introduced me to her boyfriend, a slim, wavy-haired Oklahoman named Jimmy Rogers. We sat in our motel room near the college and told Jenny and Jimmy all about the summer of service. Jenny's response was immediate. "This is just what I've always wanted, something important to do." Jimmy wasn't as demonstrative, but I could tell by his questions that he was on the hook too. "Good. I liked this young man." As we got closer to July 1st, I suddenly realized Dar and I didn't have the money for our own fees, $320 for two of us, so I sold our VW Bug. We were scrambling now to get all the final preparations done, like buying three used school buses. We tried to use them for the trek from California to Dallas, where we'd pick up more youths going on to Florida to catch our flight on Mackey Airlines onto the Bahamas. 1 week before our flight to Nassau, our three school buses piled with suitcases, loaded with volunteers, began making their long journey to Florida. Dad called to tell me that at the last minute, Phyllis and Lynn had decided to come along to help us with logistics. "And son," Dad added, his encouragement and humor coming through the line, Your mother has a word for you again. What's that, Dad? She says to remind you that either this is God's idea or you're crazy. And Lauren? Yes, Dad. I agree. We both laughed, but in fact, it was a serious observation. We could be out of our minds. On the other hand, it was possible, just possible, that we were unleashing a power that we ourselves scarcely understood.